this is Nick Ragone filling in for Ralph. Ralph, if you're out there, we hope you're feeling better, getting some chicken soup, talking to the nurses, listening to the show. We've had a really interesting show. We've had Ali Velshi on in the first hour talking a little bit about the economy. We were chatting sports with Ken Belson of the New York Times, and we have another writer from the New York Times, Paul Sullivan, coming on in a second to talk a little bit about his new book, Clutch. I was going to say, Preston, I noticed on your Facebook page, your status update mentions that I'm guest hosting today, and I love what you put in there. You have Nick Ragone, presidential expert, author, Fox News contributor, and 8-handicap golfer. Unfortunately, Paul's on the line now, and he's going to talk about my golf game because he's my frequent golf buddy.
Is he going to out you?
Well, he might out me, but...
It was pretty close. I mean, it's a 28-handicap.
So that is not even funny. That is not even funny. That's not even close to being true. But it's so ironic that Paul is a good friend, a great writer. He writes for the Times every week, and he writes the Wealth column, which he knows little about since he doesn't have any. But he writes about the Wealth column, and he's written a book called Clutch. And for those of you in front of your computer, go to Amazon and check it out. It's getting great reviews. The Wall Street Journal reviewed it a couple days ago. The Times did. It's ranked, the last I checked, Paul, was number 400 on Amazon, which is pretty good.
Yeah, I checked last night, and it was the number 6 download on an iPad, so that made me happy. People are reading it on the train.
Yes, well, that's a good place to read it. So it's a great topic, and for those of you who get a chance to look at it, Paul talks about the introduction, why he decided to take on the topic of who is clutch and who's not, and why they're clutch and why some aren't, and he tells a very personal story about how he is so not clutch on the golf course. And all I could say is I could testify to that because Paul is a very good golfer. He has a beautiful swing. He kills the ball. He hits it a ton. But from 100 yards in or for anything that matters, he's just awful, awful. And it's just it's so ironic that you wrote a book about clutch. I guess you were trying to find your own demons. Is that what it was?
I've embraced my demons. But you're right, Nick. I mean, that was the reason. I mean, there are other areas of my life where I've had to be good under pressure. But golf is something that's always frustrated me. I mean, you were with me once down in Pittsburgh at a course called Oakmont. They had 8 or 9 U.S. Opens there. Only one out of bounds on the entire course. On the first hole, I proceeded to slice the ball out of bounds. I mean, I joked. But, you know,
that's because there's a bunch of us watching on the first tee.
Well, you were also throwing stuff at me, so that didn't help either.
It's an amazing look. First of all, it's a fascinating topic. I think everybody has experienced, for lack of a better word, choking in their life, whether it's at work or playing, you know, flag football on the weekend or a $4 Nassau on the golf course or, you know, trying to get a one-liner out to a girl at a bar. I mean, we've all had moments where we've just lost our self-confidence or nerve and we've choked under pressure. And so I guess the first question is, in writing the book and talking to these different people, you've talked to athletes, business people, people in the military and others, what's the connective tissue between people who perform at their best under the most extreme duress? I mean, what's the commonality for people who excel under pressure?
Yeah, that's a great question, Nick. I mean, there are 5 key traits that I found, and it doesn't matter if you're, you know, David Boies, litigating in front of the Supreme Court, or, you know, David Price, who started the All-Star game this year. The 5 traits are focus, discipline, adaptability, being present, and what I call the push and pull of fear and desire. And what, you know, may be shocking to some people is, you know, the tennis great Billie Jean King has an awful lot in common with the banker Jamie Dimon when it comes to pressure.
Yeah, I mean, I would you have a chapter, I guess you compare Jamie Dimon to Ken Lewis, right?
I do, yeah.
I mean, and so during the bailout and the crisis, and it's pretty interesting now, Ken Lewis is out of a job. Jamie Dimon, for all intents and purposes, is the undisputed leader of the financial services industry and really did a masterful job at protecting Chase's reputation during that. But, do a case study for that. What was the difference between Ken Lewis and Jamie Dimon?
Yeah, I mean, for them, it came down quite simply to responsibility, the ability to take, you know, to take charge and say, you know what, this is my call, I'm going to handle it. And I tell the story of their 2 careers because you know, I didn't want to pick on anybody, and I try to find people in all the chapters, the choking chapters, people who, you know, were in similar situations. Ken Lewis was leading a giant commercial bank. Jamie Dimon was leading a giant investment bank. You know, their fortunes completely reversed in the course of the financial collapse. And one very telling story from Jamie Dimon is, you know, this ability to take responsibility happened quite young in his life. He was appointed CFO of a small Baltimore bank when he was 30 years old. Now, most of us would probably let that go to our heads and say, I'm the CFO, that's great. He actually got down in the dirt and started to figure out where they were spending money. And he tells me this great story. He calls a guy into his office, and the guy says, yeah, what do you need, Mr. Dimon? And he says, look here, $7,000 to water plants on the executive floor. And the guy shrugs and says, yeah, $7,000 for the whole year. Dimon stares him in the eye and says, they're artificial plants. Now, that's a bit of a throwaway story, but it shows that for somebody like Dimon, that responsibility started at an early age. When he was buying Bear Stearns, when he was buying Washington Mutual, he was in the office. He was there working through all the details. He called in all of his lieutenants. By contrast, there's a wonderful story about Ken Lewis on the verge of closing his acquisition of Merrill Lynch, and he's sitting in a room waiting to have the champagne while his underlings sort through all the details.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a microcosm, that sums it up. You know, that sums it up right there. I mean, I found that chapter to be fascinating because you don't think of CEOs as clutch or unclutch. I mean, we don't really have many opportunities to kind of peer or pierce the veil and see how they perform it. So it was interesting that you sort of compared those two. I mean, the easier way to understand it, I guess, would be sports and particularly golf, because you're alone, you're out there by yourself, you control your own destiny, you're not facing a pitcher, you're not facing a batter, you don't have a tennis player, you know, somebody standing across from you. And I saw in the Times story, you were quoted in a Times story the other day on golf, and you mentioned a quote from Jeff Ogilvie, I guess you talked to in the book, right? You talked to Jeff Ogilvie?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Former U.S. Open champion. And so the quote that you had, you were paraphrasing him, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but it was something like at the U.S. Open at Wingfoot, I guess on the 18th hole, he had about a six-footer, and your quote was, you know, the reporter said, you know, what was Jeff Ogilvie thinking? And you said, you know, what he told me was he was just saying, I hope this ends. Let me get this over with. I mean, yep. What is that? I mean, that would not seem to be the sentiment of somebody like Jack Nicklaus, for instance. You know, he was deliberate under pressure, took his time, stayed with his routine, and then pulled the trigger when he was ready. But what's your take of golfers under pressure? Why do some people perform well, like Jack or Tiger, and others, you know, Greg Norman, for instance, can't seem to get it together under the most extreme duress?
Yeah, I mean, I also talked to Tiger in the book, and you know, one of the things he told me when I met him a couple of years ago, the sort of Tiger 1.0 era, was, you know, the reason he is so good under pressure is because he'd been in that situation so many times. He'd been, you know, Sunday afternoon in the lead. He knew what it felt like. But, you know, that happens to golfers like Tiger and Jack. It doesn't happen so often to golfers like Jeff Ogilvie. I mean, he's a top 20 golfer in the world, fantastic player, but, you know, the story you bring up, he's sitting there, you know, and that 6 foot putt was important, but more important was, you know, his third shot. He'd left the second shot short, and he had this chip, the impossible chip up to the green. And he knew that, hey, this is for the U.S. Open. If I can hit it to 6 feet, I've got a chance to make that putt. But how are you going to make that chip? I mean, so many of us, I've seen you do this, Ragone. You'd scull it across the green.
And I have.
And you have, yeah. I mean, most of us would think, oh, my God, if I do this, I'm going to, you know, hit it up there, I could win the U.S. Open. He doesn't, you know, he admits that, you know, he knew it was the U.S. Open. It was a high-intensity moment, but he was blasé. Why? Because he went back to a time when he'd hit that chip before. He's hit that same chip millions of times. He knew he could do it, and that's all he had to do. He had to just, you know, the traits I talk about of being great under pressure means focus is the number one. He focused on that moment, executed the shot, and then, you know, I guess the funnier part, he's standing over that putt like any of us, and, you know, he knew how to stroke it. He had the read, but he certainly wanted it to be over.
Well, you know, you talk about concentration. I sort of, tell me if this is incorrect, but when I hear that, I interpret it as routine. And I'm talking about golf now specifically, but even in thinking about my own, you know, kind of business life and, you know, the pressure of a new business pitch or presenting to a team, you know, I think golfers that perform well under pressure, or anybody, have a routine that they stick with, and there's comfort in a routine. And if you look at golfers on the tour, they're sort of fanatical in their adherence to a pre-shot routine. And the really good ones under pressure don't vary from that an inch. They stay with that same pre-shot routine. There's a certain comfort. It allows you to recall when you're on the driving range or in a practice round that same routine. And I feel the same way about business or anything. If I go into a new business pitch or whatever, it's preparation, it's routine, approaching it the same way every time. Is that accurate? Is that simplifying it?
No, it's completely accurate in both instances. You know, with the golf example, and I talk about it in the book, I mean, these guys are fanatical about the routine, and some people may be listening and to this and think, okay, well, when I'm on the course, I have a routine, I apply it every time, but these guys are applying it on the driving range as well. They're not showing up, plopping down their 10 bucks and getting the biggest bucket of balls they can and banging them all out there in a half an hour. They'd be more apt to, you know, get 30 balls and take an hour and a half to hit those 30 balls. Each shot to them is a shot as if they're on the course. They're, you know, you can never recreate the pressure of, you know, the final two shots at the U.S. Open, but you can develop a routine that'll help you withstand it. And the same is true for, you know, your new business pitch, for anybody's pitch. I mean, I draw a distinction in the book between concentration and focus. I mean, concentration is a flashlight. You know, focus is a laser beam. Concentration going into a pitch, you're thinking of the million details that are running around in your mind, and that can ultimately be paralyzing. Focus is, I want to win this new business. Whatever I have to do to win it, I'm going to do it. I'm not going to be thrown off, and that's all I'm thinking about is that new business. You know, I'll tend to my BlackBerry buzzing in my pocket later.
Yeah, you know, we're going to go to break in a second, but I want to throw out one last thought when it comes to golf and concentration and clutch. There's a couple of great stories about Ben Hogan. I don't know if these are apocryphal or not, but you've probably heard them both. One is that he was playing around in the Open once, and his wife Valerie came up after the third or fourth hole and said hi to him, you know, on the side of the ropes or whatever. And after the round, she said, you know, he said, I don't remember seeing you. He had totally forgotten that he had seen his wife or talked to her. The other one is he was playing once with a playing partner who had a hole in one. And at the end of the round, he was going through his card and he saw the one on the card, Hogan, that he marked. And he questioned the guy. He goes, I don't remember you getting a hole in one, which would seem almost impossible. But with Hogan, you kind of understand it. He was so intensely focused on what he was doing that he literally blocked out everything.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard both those stories, and I mean, they're fantastic. But, you know, if we remember Hogan, he was just such an amazing ball striker, but, you know, comparatively, a somewhat, you know, lackluster putter. And the reason for that is, you know, his wife, the other great story about his wife, he made her shag balls for him. I mean, he would stand out there, and he would be hitting them at her. I mean, he was just, you know, completely obsessive about the trajectory, about everything about his shot, but putting wasn't the same for him. It was something just completely different. And, you know, the modern example now is, you know, Tiger 2.0. Look, I mean, the guy can never recover from his personal problems. They are what they are. But if he starts being a different Tiger on the course, if he starts being, you know, the nice, sweet Tiger who's, you know, hugging babies and signing autographs, like Phil, it's going to be disastrous because yeah. He had, you know, 35 years of being Mr. Intense, of exploding, of showing passion and showing emotion. And if he gives that up, he's never going to pass Jack's record. It's going to be a disaster for him.
This is Nick Ragone subbing for Ralph, 1560 KNZR. Paul, do you want to stay around and do a second segment? Do you have time?
Yeah.
All right, we'll come back. We're talking with Paul Sullivan, a New York Times author of the book Clutch. If you haven't, go to Amazon.com, check it out. It's doing fantastic. Been getting great reviews in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere. We're going to talk a little bit more with Paul after the break on what's the difference between somebody who's clutch and somebody who's not clutch. And for those of us who don't play sports for a living or do something, how can we all be a little bit more clutch in our daily lives? This is Nick subbing for Ralph. Back in a few. This is Nick Ragone. Back on the Ralph Bailey Show, 1560 KNZR. Preston's IMing me during the break. Remember to turn off the cough button, knucklehead. That's what he told me. The last intro, I gave a great intro. Unfortunately, nobody ever heard it because I had the cough button on. It was actually the best intro I did the whole time, so.
Wonder what Paul would say about that, you choking on
it. I know. You know, it's so funny that we're talking to Paul Sullivan, New York Times columnist, author of a book called Clutch, and the intro, I had the cough button on. I guess, you've seen me choke before, though, Paul, so that's nothing new.
Nick Rago.
Yeah, but I've never heard you say anything nice about me, so I would have liked to have heard that intro.
Yeah, it was actually good. Usually my typical intro about Paul is something like, he's kind of hairy, so he looks like a wildebeest. And he emanates a certain odor that's similar to a wildebeest as well. So, anyway, I gave you a really nice intro. Nobody ever heard it. But I've talked a lot about your book. I just pulled up the Wall Street Journal review. Their journal reviewed it, I guess, when? On Monday or Tuesday, was it?
Monday, yeah.
And they actually teamed up your book with another book that a guy wrote called Choke, which is interesting. And, you used the word – I guess you don't use the word choke a lot in the book, but really the opposite of clutch is choke. And so the question is, you could understand with athletes and people who are under pressure every day and perform in front of others, how they could perform clutch or choke. But for those of us that kind of just lead normal lives day in and day out, what are some of the things that we could do in our regular lives that, whether it's a new business pitch or presenting before the executive board or just speaking in front of 5 or 6 employees or whatever it might be, that makes us a little bit more clutch when it comes to those important moments? Is there any sort of tip or anything that you glean that will help us?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this book was to take the term out of the sports context because, I mean, given this economy, given what's happened over the past 3 years, we all need to get better under pressure. So, I mean, take the first three tips. I was talking to a mother's group a couple weeks ago, and they were saying, all right, well, we understand how our husbands have to be, good under pressure in business. We understand the sporting context, but, we're just moms. What does that mean to us? And I said, well, that's crazy. I mean, the same three traits apply. You've got a bunch of kids running around. You've got a bunch of things to do. What's the first thing you do? You focus on the key problem, on the key goal, whatever it may be. You focus on that. I mean, multitasking is a myth. It's a way to fail under pressure. Then once you focus on what you need to get done, you're disciplined at doing it. You execute it as best you can. However, we all need to be cognizant that so many of our plans, they may seem great on paper, but they ultimately fail under pressure. And that's where adaptability comes in. If we're not ready to change our plan, we're going to fail. And one of the fellows I talked to is a colonel up at West Point. And, I mean, that's pressure in a life or death situation. But he instilled the same motto into all of his cadets that the rest of us can learn from, and that's fight the fight, don't fight the plan. And that, that to me sums it up. Fight the fight, don't fight the plan. Keep in mind what you need to get done. Don't get wedded to this beautifully crafted plan that you've created.
Well, yeah, as Mike Tyson would say, the best laid plans usually go to waste when you're punched in the nose.
or when you give your Rolls Royce away.
Yeah, exactly. I hate to keep migrating back to sports, but it's the easiest way for me to understand it and sort of contextualize what you're talking about. But let's take the case of Greg Norman for a second, because I can't not talk to you about Greg Norman. I'm not sure there's anybody in sports, and I may have been A-Rod before last year, that's more associated with the term choke than Greg Norman, and who has repeatedly, 4 or 5 times, the 86 PGA, obviously the Masters, the 84 U.S. Open, the 86 U.S. Open, you go on and on and on, that has performed his worst under the most extreme pressure. In a case like that, is there something in him that either sabotages himself during pressure or his constitutional makeup just doesn't allow him to perform well? Can you be a pathological choker? I mean, talk to me about Greg Norman. I mean, anything you learned from doing this book where you could say and you sort of look at Norman and say, wow, now I get it.
Yeah. I mean, there are some stories with Norman are just bad luck. I mean, Larry Mize, that was bad luck. But the rest of them, particularly, when he was at the Masters against Nick Faldo, and he was, up like 5-6?
Six shots with 9 to go, yeah.
Yeah. And he loses it all. Why? I mean, Norman's whole persona on the course was to be the shark, was to charge ahead, was to do these daring shots, to hit the ball, as far as anyone in his day was hitting him. What happened to him when he was in contention to win a major, in all majors except the British Open? He stopped being Greg Norman. He started playing cautious. I mean, that day against Faldo at the Masters is just excruciating to watch. Why?
because he didn't play like Greg Norman.
Well, so let me ask you. So yeah. Is that a way of saying, again, I keep coming back to routine because I think of Nicklaus and I think of the great golfers, I think of great baseball players, anybody, and they just they adhere to a strict routine. Is that him in a way just coming out of his routine? He's not being him.
It is, and it's also overthinking. It's overthinking what is about to happen to him, and you know it's not his routine. He's out of his comfort zone. But you know, look at another great, you know, Seve Ballesteros. Seve could win dirty. He could hit the ball all over the map and still make the recovery shot. That wasn't Norman. I mean, Norman was belt the ball out there. You know, hit a great second shot, get the crowd behind you. He was a momentum guy.
And let me ask you about it. It's harder in my mind. It's easier to talk about clutch performers who are solo performers, like a Greg Norman or, you know, Pavarotti. I mean, there's clutch singers who perform well under pressure. Take the case of Derek Jeter, and I, you know, as everybody knows, I'm not a Yankee fan. I'm a Met fan, but I enormously respect Jeter. I think as far as team sports athletes go, I'm not sure there's a more winning athlete that I've seen ever. That's not to say he has the greatest stats ever or he's the greatest shortstop ever. He's not, but he's the greatest winner I've ever seen. What is it about Derek Jeter that make, when it comes October, whether he's had a good year or bad, when it comes to the playoffs, there's a flip of a switch and he is on? I mean, what is that, just in the DNA, or is that something you learn? How does that happen?
Yeah, I talk about that in the chapter of the book because, I mean, Jeter, I am a fan of the Yankees, and Jeter fascinates me. But if you look at his stats, he's just good. He's not, I mean, so many other players, they're great in the regular season, like, you know, an A-Rod until last year, but they fall apart in the postseason because it becomes something different to him. There's always been something very focused and very pure about Jeter. I mean, he doesn't have these monster stats. You're right. But he's just always making those plays. He's trying, you know, as hard playing a last place team, you know, late in the season as he is, you know, playing in the postseason. So it's that consistency. You know, as I define the term clutch in the book, it's the ability to do what you can do under normal circumstances, under pressure. And that's what Jeter does. I mean, to him, it is normal to be in the postseason. To him, it's normal to play hard. He knows that he's not wowed. He plays in Yankee Stadium, you know, 81 games a year at least. He's not wowed by that. And so he's a concept professor, but he knows how to focus and he knows how to keep those thoughts that, you know, hurt a Greg Norman or an A-Rod at bay.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I could continue to go on for the next 20 minutes. Preston's telling me we have to take a break. I'm with Paul Sutherland. Thank you, Paul, New York Times columnist, author of the new book, Clutch. If you haven't gone to Amazon.com, go right now, check it out. A fascinating book. There's also a great WallStreetJournal.com review of it. So if you're in front of Google, go to the Google and do Paul Sullivan, Wall Street Journal. You'll see a great review in it. Paul, thank you. Hopefully this won't make you more clutch because I still want to keep taking your money on the golf course.
I don't remember you ever doing that, but all right, if you say so.
Like Hogan, you blocked it out. I clearly remember taking your money. Anyway, thank you, Paul, for coming on. This is Nick Ragone subbing for Ralph, 1560 Cans Air. When we come back, we'll do some football picks and a little bit of trivia. Nick Ragone, back in a few.